Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we're going to be reflecting on the just concluded G20 summit that was held in Johannesburg, South Africa in November 2025. I'm joined by Professor Daniel Bradlow, Professor and Senior Research Fellow at the Center for the Advancement of Scholarship at the University of Pretoria. Professor Bradlow is also Senior Non-Resident Fellow, Global Development Policy Center in Boston, and also Professor Emeritus, American University, Washington College of Law, among many other positions. His recent book, published by Oxford University Press, is titled The Law of the International Financial Institutions. Danny, it's good to have you back again. I look forward to our conversation.
Thank you very much, Michael. It's good to be back.
Yeah, brilliant. Let's start off. To our audience that you'd be surprised, but they don't know what the G20 means. So what is the G20 and what is the agenda? What is the goal?
So the G20 was established initially in the 1990s as a group in the wake of the Asian financial crisis, as a group of finance ministers and central bank governors from what were considered to be the 20 most important economies in the world. That was never completely accurate, but it was 20 countries that were important, at least in their regions. And the idea was to create a forum that where these ministers could meet to discuss global financial and economic issues and resolve them in a format that was more contained than the United Nations or some of the other international organizations. After the financial crisis in 2008, it was elevated to the level of the heads of state and heads of government. The 20 countries are actually 19 countries plus the European Union. 2 years ago, the African Union was added as the 21st member country. In addition, there are usually a number of invited guests which of other countries which are added. So by the end, you end up with many more than 20 countries, but it's a relatively elite group, I suppose.
So but looking at that, but before we get into the controversies with the actual summit that was held, if we just look at the composition and what it seems to, when you say important, and I've seen where people say rich countries as well, rich and developing countries, and you look at all of these, how does that reflect the current, or does that mirror the current inequality, global inequality? Or the current shift in alliances that have been formed, or how do I put it in terms of the world order? Does it have any kind of reflection on that? Or
so I would say, it's certainly a more representative group than the G7, which used to see itself as the management committee in a sense for the global economy. These 20 countries are not the 20 largest countries, largest economies. So, for example, South Africa's one of the G20 and has been from the beginning, but it's not one of the 20 largest economies in the world. But it was a need to have some African representation, and so South Africa was included. Similarly, Argentina's in the list, probably also not one of the 20 largest, but it's an important country in its region. So it's a group that's more representative than the G7. It includes both countries from the global north and the global south. So in that sense, it's more representative, but it's a problematic grouping. It's self-selected. So it's not, you know, there's no justification beyond they thought they were the most important countries. They do represent probably about 80% of the global economy. So it is an important grouping because it has India and China and Indonesia and the United States. It has the most populous countries in the world. So in that sense, it's also representative. But there is a problem in the sense that there are 20 countries out of 193, and the other countries don't have any formal representation. And that should be adjusted in some way to make it more representative of the globe.
Again, you mentioned, so this originally was formed from the Asian crisis in the 90s and then upgraded following the financial crisis in the Dubai recession 2009. Do you think the bringing together the politics and economics, because it was originally like finance ministers, and so do you think that is effective? Has that been effective? Is that problematic?
So, I mean, I suppose it's glass half full, glass half empty is probably the fair way of doing it. Because at the time of the global financial crisis in 2008, the fact that you had the political leaders there, as well as the economic and finance people there, meant that the world could come together and could coordinate their actions to mitigate the effects of the crisis. And I think it's fair to say that the world suffered less than it would have because the G20 was able to coordinate action. The danger of having it, bringing the politics in, when you have heads of state and heads of government in a meeting, whatever they think is important is going to be on the agenda. And so the agenda of the G20 has grown and spread dramatically. And I mean, it covers whatever is an important issue at the time. And that is a problem. And in fact, one of the things South Africa tried to do was to start a process called G20 at 20, seeing that this was the 20th G20 summit, is to review what the G20 is doing and to try streamline the process in some way. And the US has said that this year, 2026, that they, as the president, will do that more. I mean, I'll leave it to you to decide whether you think that's likely to be a positive outcome or not.
But, we'll get to that in a minute. But thank you for bringing us, shifting our focus back. So G20 rotational summit every year. So it was first in Africa in November 25. And like Riley said, then President Ramaphosa used that as an opportunity to highlight or to refocus or bring attention to what the summit is and all of that. And so what is the symbolism of, do you think it's a symbolic victory, or do you think there's any kind of significant victory or significant work that has made from South Africa hosting the G20 for the first time in Africa last year?
Right, so it was the first time in the African continent. I would say the big achievement of South Africa, working with the African Union as the other African participant, was that it focused global attention on Africa and African issues. So, for example, the debt issue received more attention than it might have. Climate finance, food security were issues which are priority areas for Africa that received attention. So that's the positive side. And there were some things that came out of that, for example, a G20 compact with Africa, which is meant to deal with some of Africa's problems going forward. The problem is, because there's such a disagreement and division in the world, what came out is really a statement of good intentions rather than concrete actions. And so that the challenge for South Africa and the continent going forward is going to be, How is there a way we can take what was agreed in the G20 declaration and turn it into concrete action? And I mean, obviously, in the current environment, that's a big challenge.
Yeah, I can imagine that. We'll come back to that. So speaking of that, speaking of the kind of power the G20 has, before we talk to whether it is a symbolic statement or concrete steps can be taken, one other significant thing that happened was the U.S. boycotting, which you mentioned in your statement previously. Why did why did Donald Trump boycott? What is the implication of that?
So, I mean, I don't know how to understand what Donald Trump does. Sometimes it's not easy.
But
the U.S. said that they didn't like South Africa's priorities for the G20. So South Africa had said that their priorities were solidarity, equality, and sustainability, which just sounds a lot like the diversity, equality, and inclusive agenda that Trump doesn't like. So they said that's why they're staying away. As you know, he also has a disagreement with South Africa, his absurd claim that there's discrimination against, or genocide, not even just discrimination against white Afrikaners. So I think politically he decided that this was not something he wanted to attend. For a while it looked like he would send the vice president. And in the end they decided not to do that. And I think it was a way of sending a message both that they don't like multilateralism as a general principle, and they don't like the fact, and particularly they don't like the fact that countries in the global south are beginning to push an agenda that's more responsive to the needs of the global south than to what he perceives as the priorities of his agenda.
But it's quite interesting that but maybe I would digress a bit, because you mentioned multilateralism and look at how also maybe the paradox that the Trump administration presents, or the irony, on one hand looking at a America First kind of policy, but on the other hand we've seen where the Trump administration are intervening in Iran, for instance, intervention in Venezuela and all of these places. So how do we resolve this ironies? The administration is withdrawing from UN, multiple UN organizations, and on the other hand, threatening intervening in all these places. What's your assessment of that?
I think President Trump feels that these multilateral institutions are a hindrance to achieving his Make America Great and America First agenda. He's not interested in promoting cooperation. He's interested in a more domineering approach. I think it's important to keep in mind, if you go back and you look when President Reagan was president, before he came into office, he also said he thought organizations like the IMF were terrible, they were useless, they shouldn't exist. And then he came in, and then there was the Latin American debt crisis. And suddenly he decided, actually, these institutions can be quite useful. And he even contributed more money to them. So it's possible that if there's a crisis somewhere that affects the United States, that Trump's approach to some of these institutions could change. But at the moment, it would be sort of surprising. He doesn't look like that's the approach he's interested in. But I think one of the things that the G20 showed, and President Ramaphosa with his deft diplomacy showed, is that there's a way for the world to move forward whether or not the US wants to participate. And I think that did not please President Trump very much. But it's an important message, because the important problems that the world's facing, and we can't sit around waiting for every country to agree to participate. Even when everyone's there, it's difficult to reach agreement. But if they don't want to participate, then we can't wait for them. We need to move forward anyhow.
Looking at how I think we had this conversation the last time, and looking at how like you rightly said, there's no one country. We live in a world where some people say it's multipolar. Some people say there's no hegemon and all of that. But looking at Africa and looking at how the significance of the G summit in Africa and how President Ramaphosa used the, I think, the principle of Ubuntu, or trying to show what African can contribute to. So how would you assess Africa's role in dealing with some of these issues that affect the continent of the zone and the global as well? Do you think Africa has something to offer, and how is it playing that role?
So I think, I mean, certainly in a very sort of traditional way, that Africa has the minerals that the world needs for in this the new age. So the critical minerals is an important part of the agenda. Africa also has something to offer in the sense that a lot of the world is aging. Mm. Our continent is the one continent that that's not true of. And where there are a lot of young people who are going to need work and opportunities. And so that Africa can offer the world the possibility of filling a gap until while they those countries age and we get younger, at least, or more. We have young people who can work.
Oh, you've heard, sorry to cut you short, we've heard Elon Musk saying yesterday that people shouldn't bother about that. In the next 4 years, AI and robots will take over.
Well, it's possible. And I mean, that's obviously a serious worry, but there are many things that human beings are still going to be needed for. And I suspect AI will do add a lot, but it's probably not going to do it for a long time. And so we still need some human beings to work. So that, I mean, I think that's another thing where Africa has a contribution to make. I mean, in terms of climate issues, Africa is going to be very badly affected, but it also, the world's going to need to think carefully about where it grows food, where's how to produce food security. There's a lot of land in Africa that is not being used and could be used to help feed the world and to develop the continent. So there are things where Africa can say to the world, we offer you opportunities and things that you need, but we need things as well. We need the resources to develop and the support that to educate and deal with our populations. And so there is a basis for making some sort of a kind of political bargain. The problem is that the world in at the moment anyhow seems to be sort of moving in the opposite direction from looking at for an agreement like that. But at some point one hopes people will wake up and say, look, these crises, you know, climate, inequality, the public health are becoming too important, and we need to deal with them in a more constructive way.
Speaking of the bargaining power and bargains, we've seen where, also looking at Trump's kind of like behavior approach, transactional approach. And again, these summits are looking to be where the host country used to emphasize their kind of agenda. Now, looking at how I think with the South African the summit hosted, how they tried to link it to the African continental free trade.
Yeah.
How do you think? Was that successful in a way, or do you think that has a prospect?
I mean, to be honest, I think the African Continental Free Trade Agreement is vitally important for the continent, whatever the rest of the world thinks in a way. Because, I mean, we don't trade enough amongst ourselves to support our development, and we need to do that. I don't know that the G20 did much to advance the Continental Free Trade Agreement. I think they're definitely countries, I mean, I think we're in a process in the trade area all around the world of countries rethinking because of the way the US is behaving. And so that countries are looking for new trading partners. And so there's bilateral deals in a way that can be made, you know, between Europe and Africa, between China and Africa, India and Africa. And there won't be, you know, India and 54 African countries. It'll be with smaller groups. But if those groups start developing and they have links to other African countries, that can be a way to expand the trade on the continent as well. But I mean, we're over a billion people on the continent, and you know, that's a big opportunity. And that if we don't exploit that opportunity, the chances of the continent doing well are reduced significantly.
You mentioned that there are two things you mentioned that are also in my research I've been looking at. So the, on one hand, we have the youth population that offers a lot of prospects as well. But we've been seeing some kind of, will I say, political consciousness among the youth, which you put in a particular generation that are far removed from their colonial narrative or post-colonial narrative, that are more concerned about, worried about, you know, the unemployment, the contemporary issues, you know, that they deal with their leadership. Mm-hmm. And so what we've seen, even from South Africa to Kenya to Madagascar, so we've seen all of this kind of youth uprising coming up that have been also hijacked by authoritarian or the military. So I guess the question is, we're seeing opportunities, but we're also seeing all of these challenges. How does this secure Africa in the long run? Or how are we able to control or harness this potential? So that, you know, it could also be used negatively or turned out negatively. Yeah.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think young people have very valid grounds for being concerned. I mean, jobs are not being created. The opportunities are not there for them. The leadership is... are their grandparents' generation, if not their great-grandparents' generation in some cases. And that's a serious problem for the continent, and it has to be dealt with in some way, because, I mean, having a young population is an opportunity, but it's also a risk if you don't manage it properly. And as you mentioned, I mean, there are a number of countries where you can see the opportunity is becoming a risk because the leadership hasn't responded constructively. I mean, it's important. Young people are also going to have to accept that we can't change the bad situation that's developed over the last few decades overnight. It's going to be a slower process, but they're absolutely right that they should be confident that there is a process that is moving in the right direction and that takes them into account in ways that they can see that there's a chance for them to have a better life than it looks like right now.
But speaking of that leadership, so we've seen, you were talking about bilateral agreement. So one of the things I've seen over time in recent years is, again, we can interpret this in several ways. So we've been seeing these different summits. We saw it from Obama, the first American-Africa summit. We've seen China-Africa summit. It's happened, I think, twice now. We've seen Russia-Africa summit. We've seen India, because we've seen Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has come up with its development policy in Africa, 2030 policy, and all of this with African. How do all of these bring prosperity to Africa? And the kind of leadership we have in Africa, are they? Well, in my own opinion, we've not have leaders that are selfless. I think we've had leaders that are self-serving. But how are they able to translate these for the prosperity and for the benefit of the African people?
I mean, you know, there's something a little bit weird about China meeting with the entire continent rather than meeting with one country at a time. And it doesn't speak well of Africa that we do that. But on the other hand, it might just be pragmatic to say that's the best way of advancing. You know, we have a better chance of having a bargain with China at that level than if we do it individually. So that's the one issue. I think part of the issue is we need, and I think they exist now, a sort of cadre of people across the continent who have the technical knowledge and expertise that they can negotiate effectively with other countries to get agreements that will work for the continent in the most effective way. The challenge often is, as you suggest, is sometimes the leaders have an agenda which isn't willing to do what's best and for everyone, as long as they can get whatever it is that they particular want. And then it's up to us to hold our leaders accountable, which is easy to say, of course, and not so easy to do. But in a way, there's not a lot of a choice. I mean, if you have a leader who can keep power for 40 or 50 years, and the country that sort of de facto accepts that. The rest of the world doesn't really have an ability to do very much to change that reality. The continent could do more, maybe, through the African Union, is to hold countries and say, look, here are the standards we expect of good governance in every African country. And if not, we're going to call you out and help your people to at least manage that situation.
Okay, go on. I think you still.
The only thing I was going to say is, I think sometimes we overemphasize sovereignty, because that's often the excuse that governments use is, don't interfere in domestic affairs. This is our affair. You stay out of it. And I'm not convinced that in the world we live in today, that's the best approach.
I was going to mention because again, we're going to look at how. The African Union. I was going to look at the effectiveness or even the usefulness or utility of the African Union. We've seen where it's transformed from OAU to the African Union, but we've seen where in some cases, very limited cases, where it's acted, like recently in Benin, where with the threat of the coup, where it acted. But in other places where you see elections that are unfair, that are clearly unfair, where the leaders have entrenched themselves or keep pushing the gokus or manipulating the constitution to extend it, the African Union has been less effective in intervening in those places. So what I'm saying is, when we talk about the choices that people have and look at institutions that are supposed to protect those rights, and I look at how the African people are warming up to authoritarian government, military government, Do we really have a choice? What is the way out?
It's difficult. I mean, one of the ways out is to say any institution that has the authority and the power to exercise, to have an effect on people's lives, must have a way of being held accountable and being held accountable to the people who are affected by what they do. At the moment with the African Union, for example, it's accountable to the member states. But it's not accountable to the people don't have any way of saying, hang on a second, what you're doing is unacceptable and we want to hold you accountable for that in some way. It's not easy, but there are mechanisms that in some international organizations can be used to do that. There can be ways to create forums so that civil society groups, business community, labor organizations, can have a role in these organizations, and so that there's a way to say what you're doing is unacceptable. We understand why you behave like that, but it's unacceptable. We want you to change and take our interests into account more. It's not easy, but I don't think that there's any other way really other than that. I think in the case of the African Union, we should also say Africa must support the African Union. We're not accepting money and support from the European Union or the China or whoever. This is our organization and it's our responsibility to give it the resources it needs to operate effectively. And if you're not willing to do that, then we must admit that we're not serious about.
I agree with you. And we did talk about this when we spoke about the Africa multilateral in the last episode that you appeared on. But speaking of that, it's also where Africa also has to learn to, like you said, something about accept the fact that there are certain things in history that we can't change, and move away from externalizing our problems and really looking inward and looking at the resources we have, and look at those resources can be used in a way to move our interests. And that's what I say in my research as well. There's no altruistic intervention. Everyone has a strategic interest. So what Africa needs is to be able to negotiate his interest. But speaking about that, so we've been seeing a lot of Trump again. We've seen a lot of threats, tariffs, the visa restrictions. But the latest is also threatening, saying South Africa is not invited to the next G20 summit. Yeah. Do you think can America do that? Can you bar a founding member from coming? Is that legal? Is that within the G20?
You know, the thing is, the G20 is an informal grouping, so legally there are no rules. I mean, it's a serious threat to the and challenge to the whole G20 to say we agreed that these are the founding members, and now you are just deciding not to invite them, and that's unacceptable. The problem is what can you do about it? I mean, if South Africa tried to arrive, firstly, they've got to get visas, which could be an issue. Secondly, when they arrive at the hall and try to enter the meeting, you know, American police are certainly capable of stopping South African diplomats from entering if they want to. Other members have complained and have expressed their opposition. The sad reality is they're going to say they oppose and they express their concern, but they're not really going to withdraw from the meeting. I mean, we're just not an important enough country for them to be willing to do that. But I think in 2027, when the UK takes over the leadership of the G20, South Africa will be invited back. And it's important to remember also, the G20 is important, but it's just one forum. There are other forums where South Africa can be participating and can raise and advance the agenda from that it set up last year. So, for example, the G7 this year is chaired by France, which has made it clear that they want to work with other countries, and South Africa will be a participant as an invited participant at some of those meetings, and some of the issues that were raised in the South African agenda will be taken up there, and hopefully some progress can be made. The UK is beginning, will probably begin earlier to begin working on its program for the G20. And then, you know, the UN, the World Bank and IMF annual meetings, there are other places where the same issues can be brought up and advanced as well.
Yeah, speaking of all of these other places, we've seen one of the platforms that South Africa belongs to that has riled Donald Trump up is the BRICS. Can you speak to that?
So, I mean, the BRICS is an important forum. It's grown beyond the five original countries, and it is now, I suppose, technically the BRICS plus with about another five member countries. It's important, but it's not clear how much of the interests of the countries are aligned with each other. I mean, the internal tensions, when they speak with one voice, they're important because you've got most of the leading countries from the global south in the organization, and they're leading countries in the world. But for example, they'll all agree that you need reform of the international organizations, of the UN, the IMF, the World Bank. But when you get right down to it and say, well, what are the reforms you want? For example, Russia and China will say, no, we don't want to get rid of the veto in the UN Security Council. If you look at reforming the quota formulas in the IMF, how countries get allocated votes and access to the institution, some countries like India and China with big populations have a different approach to how they would like the formula changed to a country like Eswatini or Burkina Faso, which have small populations and have a very different view of how that should be. So it's very difficult to get agreement, but the BRICS are making some progress. They're trying to develop more links between each other. They've created new institutions like the New Development Bank, but they're not functioning very impressively at the moment. So they're not really an alternative. But sometimes it takes a while for these institutions to find their feet and get going. So it's possible that over time they'll become better. I mean, another one which is less formal in a way, but sort of predates the BRICS is IBSA, is India, Brazil, South Africa. And in a way, that's an easier group to work with because the countries have similar approaches, similar problems, and they can take positions in other international organizations where they can work together. So there are ways to do that. And that might be the sort of the best approach, is to say, what are the subgroups where we can magnify our voice? And, you know, on this particular issue, we all agree, even if we disagree on all sorts of other things.
There have been some people, even in the literature, where that have argued for the place of a hegemon, of having a hegemonic power, where they've looked at it in terms of effectiveness in terms of attending to these kind of like global issues. And a lot of people will say the kind of vacuum we have in power is what is causing all of this problem. Do you agree that we should have a super hegemon? Where do you think the world would be a better place with this world? Do you think we should have all these different alliances and, you know, at the sub-level?
Yeah. I mean, I can see the argument. Well, if you have one hegemon that can discipline everybody, even if it's in their own interest, maybe the system works more smoothly. But given that we don't come from a country that's ever likely to be the hegemon, I can see the downside of that as well. And to the extent that we can promote sort of the rule of law and a more multilateral approach, to me, that seems more viable. And given, you know, for the first time in human history, the climate is an issue that you cannot solve at a local level. You have to solve it at a global level. And that changes the way we all have to think about the world and international affairs. And having one hegemon would not solve that problem. You have to have everybody buying into it. And I think also we have to recognize that, you know, there are many companies that are much more powerful than states. There are philanthropies that in some ways are more influential than states. So we need a system that is not so rigid about sovereignty, but just says you need to bring in all the actors who have influence and have them all work together in some way. I mean, it's not simple, but one hegemon is not going to be able to discipline all that. And I mean, maybe it's my bias, but I don't expect the next hegemon to be any more progressive than the last hegemon. They're all the same.
not just your bias. A lot of people agree with you. They won't be a clear. It seems like we won't have a clear hegemon like we used to have in the past. And maybe that also speak to the dynamics of the world we live in today. Like Riley said, no problem is very local. You know, everything seems to be interconnected. But let's come to the last question, and let's have like a wide range kind of approach to this and say, okay, on one hand, where do we see the world going to in terms of, let's say, in the next 5 years, with everything going on, with Trump, you know, going berserk, you know, even threatening, you know, allies like NATO allies, Greenland and all of the, we see other NATO scramble and say if Trump was ever to attack Greenland, then that would be the end of NATO. And seeing division within G20, seeing division within the BRICS, seeing AUSDs, where do you see the world going to, and where do we see Africa? Let's enter Africa in all of this. Where does Africa play a role? Will Africa come out? Because in the past as well, we've always removed the leverage or the lever of power Africa has in manipulating or exploiting all of this kind of like geopolitical competition. Where does Africa come in? How can it leverage all of this for its own benefit?
So, I mean, to start with, because you asked some very complicated questions there. As I was preparing for this, I was thinking, since the G20 summit in November, I mean, the U.S. has bombed Nigeria. It's bombed
Venezuela.
I mean, it's removed the leader in Venezuela. It's threatening Iran and Greenland. It's threatening to impose more tariffs on countries if they trade with Iran. I mean, the world's becoming more lawless in a sense than it was a few months ago. And there's no reason to think in the short run that's going to change very much. It's a complicated situation, and maybe the US runs up against the limits of its actual power at some point. I mean, I expect that it will, and I don't. The problem is when it does, it might react in a way that we're not very happy with. Could be very dangerous for the world. But I mean, I think on the other hand, the second point is, for the first time, we're witnessing a superpower destroying its own power and withdrawing from the world that it's the hegemon in, voluntarily. I mean, no one, it's not being forced to do it, it's doing it on its own initiative. So that creates a very weird situation for the world. And it unleashes tensions which are going to be difficult to manage. But it does mean that those countries that want to react constructively to this and work together at least have some space to try that. I mean, if it's possible they get overwhelmed by negative forces, but they can at least try that. Where that leaves Africa is a much more complicated question. I mean, yes, Africa has lots of potential and lots of room to become a very dynamic continent over time, but we're talking about forces that are moving very fast, and Africa's not moving quite as fast as that in the short run. I think it means those of us who worry about these issues, the diplomats and the leaders who are serious about trying to make Africa advance, have to work out ways to both work within the continent to help us grow, but also to say who are the not real friends, because I don't think countries really have friends. They have, you know, people with other countries with common interests that you can work together with. So who strategically and tactically can we use as allies, at least on certain issues, so that we can maneuver between all these different forces to maximize our opportunities? It's going to be slow, and given the levels of poverty and concern on the continent, it's not going to be a simple simple process to do that. But I think if young people can see that their leaders are really trying and that they're listening to them and trying to take their interests into account, there's the potential for people to start working together and maybe move the process in an accelerating way in the right direction. But that's the wishful approach, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I agree 100%. And I've just make a small comment regarding that. I believe so much in the youth taking the lead, and in a way that is effective, that is more effective rather than street protests and all of that. But I think the youth can make their leaders accountable and support them to do what is right and negotiate the best. Professor Bradlow, it's always interesting having a conversation with you. We could go all day, but I really do appreciate your rich insights into this particular topic. And one of these days when I visit South Africa, definitely.
Please, yes. Tell me when you're here.
We will get together. But other than that, take care of yourself and have a very great day.
Thank you. You too. Cheers.
Yeah, bye. Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode. And join me as usual to thank our returning guest, Professor Daniel Bradlow, for such a deep and rich and interesting conversation on the G20 summit and, you know, other geopolitical issues, international affairs issues. For now, stay blessed, and I'll see you next time.